You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It's Wednesday, April 11th, 2023. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. I read a story in The New Yorker, an excellent story by Catherine Schultz, who is becoming one of my favorite writers, one of those for whom you see the byline, you don't skip the story. So the story was about a mother who became a leader for gay liberation because her son was gay. And this was in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. And the son handled a beating and engaged in activism, and the mother stood by him and supported him every step of the way. And the problem with the story, actually, let me change that. There was no problem with the story. There was no problem with the history. The problem was with me, because the name of the main character's son was, well, let's hear from the audio version of the New Yorker story.
The woman's name was Jean Manford, and she was marching alongside her 21-year-old gay son, Morty.
Morty Manford. And look, there is nothing wrong with the name Morty. Many accomplished, cool people have been named Morty. But the actual Morty in the story, he was an heroic, fully fleshed out character. But I am so ruined by fiction that I couldn't get past the Mortiness of it all.
By all accounts, Morty was the superstar of the Manford family. Kids liked him, adults adored him, and his teachers predicted that he would someday be a senator.
Right. Senator Morty. Everyone whose hero's journey I follow has a cool name picked out by a screenwriter. They're all Logans and Romans and Shivs, so dubbed for an artistic reason. Or they're Tywins and Tyrions and Arya Starks. Or if they're comedic, they're Ned Schneebleys or Fielding Mellishes. Or how about this? Think about the relatable everyman characters, relatable everyman Tom Hanks plays. In his Oscar-nominated roles, he was Chuck in Castaway, Josh in Big, Andrew in Philadelphia, Captain John Miller in Saving Private Ryan. And yeah, he played a Forrest and a Fred, but that was Gump and Rogers. He had to do that. His characters, when someone gets to pick the name, are always solidly named for American everymen. You don't just randomly name a Tom Hanks character Morty and hope for the heroism to overcome that. The dweeby preteen grandson of an interstellar genius, Rick, he's the guy you name Morty.
I'm familiar with the bubble, Morty.
Artistic choice. Stories, carefully crafted and constructed stories, are misleading me. They're misleading all of us. I cannot accept the possibility that a hero will rise and his name will be Morty. Just as it never rains in narrative television except to make a point, and just as no one ever has a scar or a limp without that conveying character, so too are names in fiction signals to character. But it doesn't work that way in real life. And this is, once more, my problem, not the New Yorkers, not the mother, Jean, who comes across as fierce, loving, and brave. But I gotta say, if they ever adapt this story for a teleplay, I don't think you'll get a scene of the lioness mother growling to a would-be predator. I'm not saying that if the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King were popularly known as Marty King, he'd be less impactful. But MLK was a rhetorician. He knew not to call himself Marty King, and he certainly wouldn't be a Morty. I know all over the world there are noble Normans and scintillating Sheldons and loud and lion-hearted Larrys. But in fiction, those names don't take the lead. They take the brunt of the indignities. And it's all because fiction, even challenging fiction, necessarily caters to us on so many levels. I do not blame the form, but I do recognize that it warps me a little and it warps reality. It's just too tempting to affix every Tom, Dick, and Harry with a name that confers information, when really a name is just a label, it's not a character trait. On the show today, the Good Friday Agreements and the paucity of protocols, the absence of accords. Where have all the treaties gone? But first, former lead COVID reporter for the New York Times, Donald G. McNeil, is back. Today we talk about the public's puzzling reaction to life-saving vaccines, how badly the Trump administration handled the pandemic, what his assessment of Deborah Birx was, and if he thinks Twitter should have suppressed misinformation, or should they have reacted with more humility about what was then being labeled misinformation. Donald McNeil Jr. up next.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Donald McNeil Jr. was a prominent part of the New York Times reporting team that won the Pulitzer for their coverage of COVID. He is, simply put, an expert on plagues, and he brings his expertise back to us right now. I started by asking this question. When you introduce a vaccine to, say, Africa, you will get a lot of cultural resistance, people who don't want it, who don't understand it. Public health officials know that. They know they have to do a certain kind of communication in those countries. But then a version of that happened here. And I was reading Michael Lewis, especially writing about how overcoming big cultural hurdles for vaccine uptake in the U.S. came as a surprise to a lot of experts. The question is, did it come as a surprise to you?
I hoped from the beginning that we would come together as a people in the face of a great danger, as we did in World War II. You know, I heard my parents talk about World War II. As to some extent we did in 1918, but if you read the histories of 1918 and the Anti-Mask League of San Francisco and stuff in my hometown, you can see that there was a lot of dispute going on back then. I hoped we would come together and recognize the threat of the virus, and instead we completely failed. We have not yet come together, and it polarized the country that much more. But that is part and parcel of the whole problem of Trump polarizing the country and everything. On the vaccines, I always knew there was a strong anti-vaccine movement in this country. There is a people's acceptance of vaccines has a lot to do with how afraid they are of the virus itself. There was not so much vaccine resistance in Africa as there was vaccine indifference. Many people because the virus didn't kill that many people in most of Africa. It did kill a lot in South Africa, and that's where you had the emergence of two different variants, the Omicron, and before that, I think it was the Beta that emerged there. When people are afraid, they're more likely to accept a vaccine. When you have an outbreak in a community, even in a community that's resistant to vaccine, you tend to have the vaccination rates shoot up, whether that's among the Amish, among the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Brooklyn, whatever group you might have. Once the danger is present and somebody's kid is hurt and you see that, then people tend to accept the vaccines. Here, the constant drumbeat of vaccine resistance and how that became your way of signaling your political allegiance overwhelmed that natural tendency to get a vaccine when you see somebody dying of the disease that you're talking about. I said at the very beginning of this, we're not all going to die, but we're all going to know somebody who died. And, I know three people who died, and I'm sure other people know people who died in this. And you'd think that would convert them to say, okay, I don't want that for me. I don't want that for my kids. I don't want that for my grandmother. Let's go get vaccinated. But, we got polarized and paralyzed.
What do you think of the Great Barrington Declaration? I'm of a couple minds. One, well, I know what I think about the late censorship, shall we say, by social media. But on the one hand, people who are adherents to that way of thinking point to the fact that they early on said lockdowns have these great costs. But on the other hand, the reason they said we should avoid them is because herd immunity will take effect. So what are your thoughts?
That was always nonsense, period. Okay. I mean, yeah, you can achieve herd immunity by letting the virus blow through the population. And yes, absolutely, lockdowns have costs. Although it depends on how you do the lockdown, because if you do the lockdown well enough to actually stop the virus, as China did, and you can control it, you could actually... I mean, had China got their people to accept vaccines better, they would have been an absolute genius at having handled this pandemic, even though it started. There was no question of keeping it out of the country. It started there. But no... I hated the Great Barrington Declaration and the people who were pushing that line even before the Great Barrington Declaration was written. The idea was that you can somehow hide away all the vulnerable. But if you look at, you know, what percentage of this country is over 65, what percentage of this country is, you know, over 30 plus BMI, what percentage of this country has, you know, 3% of this country has some sort of immune compromising condition. You can't hide all the fat people. You can't hide all the old people. You can't hide all the immunocompromised people because those people have jobs and families and kids and things to do. And so when you let the population, you let the, you know, the virus blow through the population, you end up with a lot of dead people. You think that we could hide people in nursing homes, but nursing homes were the hardest hit, and not just here, they were the hardest hit in Belgium and in many other countries. You know, you think that one place where you could isolate people, but it didn't. People in nursing homes need care. They're incredibly vulnerable. So we had, you know, one nursing home near me in Brooklyn had 60 dead in the early days of the pandemic. It's the notion that you achieve herd. I mean, yeah, you can do it. You will get herd immunity, but it's the path through the graveyards, and you're accepting a much higher death rate. And if you have an alternative to that, I'd go with the alternative.
I'm compelled, by the way. You make a good case. I'm glad I got to hear the case. The argument would be, so let the case be made and people make up their own minds. But it is a very vulnerable time in our country. What do you think of the media?
You can't really let people, unfortunately, in public health crises, you can't let people make up their own minds because some will just choose to put themselves in danger. I mean, we know that from AIDS. We know that from skydiving. We know that from mountain climbing. We know that from all sorts of people. But the problem is with a communicable disease, you're not just putting yourself in danger. You know, when you climb a mountain by yourself, unless you're roped into five other people you're going to take with you, you're probably going to die by yourself. But if you're spreading a disease, and particularly when we don't have a vaccine for that disease, and we know that it has a fatality rate, and we know that there are vulnerable people, it's not just up to you to decide for yourself whether or not you're going to isolate, whether or not you're going to, you know, travel, go to parties, hold a wedding, things like that. No, we have bans for good reasons. We have, you know, same way we have, you know, in theory, bans on, you know, firing guns in the street. You know, you may be able to possess a gun, but it doesn't mean you walk down the street shooting it. You certainly can't walk down the street shooting it at other people. And that's the analogy to stepping into an airplane or a subway car or an elevator when you're spewing virus. You know, you are, and that's how the case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts got decided back in 1905. The court recognized it's not about your personal desire to have a vaccine or not have a vaccine or the integrity of your body or your religious convictions or anything else. It's about the police power of the state. You have a lethal disease in those days with smallpox. You can't go out and infect other people. So we are going to vaccinate you. Now, they didn't force vaccination. What they did was punish people with a fine for not vaccinating. It was a $5 fine back then. But the principle was, due to the police power of the state, the state's duty to protect other people from a lethal threat, we can restrict people's freedoms and cause and compel them to vaccinate. And the longer I cover public health, the more of a fascist I become. It's sad. People tell me never to say that, but I've just watched so many places, so many pandemics just blow through populations because people take the attitude of, I won't do it and you can't make me, you know, like me as a 9-year-old. And, you know, you may portray that as flying a flag saying, don't tread on me. But it really is, I won't do it and you can't make me. And, you know, the state can make you do things. The state can make you pay your taxes. The state can make you wear seatbelts. The state can make you do a number of other things, even though you don't like it. The question is whether or not, you know, how feasible it is to enforce that and whether we think it's a good idea or it's going to cause, you know, somebody to be unelected from office.
I'll give you some free PR spin on the fascist line. You might want to say, go back to founding principles. The Declaration talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life comes before liberty in their assessment and yours.
Absolutely.
Was Deborah, I've heard your thoughts on Fauci, was Deborah Birx complicit? I mean, or was she playing a bad hand as best she could?
I would never use the word complicit.
It is charged.
I think she was... I think she was just too hesitant to fight back. I think she got caught up in the... I mean, there was internal White House politics, so that there was a White House task force and there was a battle within the White House task force. And Alex Azar was not an incompetent leader of the task force. He got removed and Mike Pence was put in. Mike Pence didn't... was a throw pillow and knew nothing about the disease. And then the task force got even more divided when Trump brought in Scott Atlas, who was not only the perpetrator of, the great Barrington-like herd immunity idea, but also believed that there was a whole lot of natural immunity due to previous infections, quote, T-cell immunity with benign coronaviruses. And that was just totally and completely untrue, bad, ridiculous science. Because it sounded sciency, it sounded like it might be plausible, maybe plausible to that, and he was arguing in the summer of 2020 that when cases were low, that don't worry, the virus is not going to come back in the fall. Well, the virus not only came back in the fall, that fall to winter was when we had the big killing, and 900,000 people have died since Scott Atlas said those things about, this kind of natural immunity. So Deborah Birx was stuck in a divided White House with the president listening to only to the advice that supported his point of view of things. And I don't think she was a paragon of courage. I do not think she wanted to stand up and battle with people. And she ultimately just kind of went off on a road trip, talking about the virus, around the country. Because
she'd show up in the Dakotas and in Iowa. This was seen as great public messaging. But of course, it was her trying to get away from the grip of the White House.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think more people should have just stood up and said, this is dangerously wrong. The president is dangerously wrong. You really shouldn't listen to him. And unfortunately, that would have, it wouldn't have just been fire Fauci. It would have been fire Birx. It would have been fire... Redfield, but many people needed to stand up and say, look, it's this advice is wrong and people are going to die as a result. And only Fauci did. And even he tried to do it in a way that was very controlled and not as confrontational as he could have been.
Right. Well, some of the generals did in the area of the military, but we weren't in an active shooting war at the time, I guess, is what you would say about that. Maybe they'd have a different calculation if we were. So as of now, there are hundreds of people a day dying of COVID. Should we look at that? Should we shake ourselves and say, this is an Airbus 340 or maybe maybe not a 737, but a 727 slamming into the side of a mountain every day? Why aren't we more up in arms about this? Or should we take into account many of the other factors that vaccines are available, that the average age of the person dying is probably, I think, over 80? How do you look at it?
I look at it as now we've reached the point in the epidemic where it's hard to know exactly what the reporting shows on these deaths. Some of these people are dying of COVID. Some of them are dying with COVID of other things. And as is the case with flu, it's normal, particularly this time of year, if you develop a respiratory disease, whether it's flu, whether it's COVID, or whether it's anything else, it makes it harder for you to clear your lungs. You are likely to have, if you already have respiratory, COPD or something else that gives you depressed respiratory function, or if you have cardiac problems, that's likely to be the thing that tips you over the edge. So I do notice that it is still, you are four times as likely to die with COVID if you are four times as likely to die if you are unvaccinated than if you are vaccinated. The gap has been wider in the past, but now we're looking at mostly at very old people who are dying, and COVID is one of the consequences, one of the triggers for their death. There's often underlying functions. I mean, we're seeing what's been predicted from the very beginning, which is that it's most likely to kill the vulnerable, the aged, the immune compromised, the people with underlying conditions, and that's mostly who it's killing now. So I it's bad. Do I wish everybody would go get vaccinated? Do I wish everybody had five total shots like I do? Yes, but I don't know. Short of the point of a gun, I don't know how to convince them to do it. Other than you lay the hay down where the horses can get at it, but you can't necessarily shove their noses in it until they actually eat. Some people are still resisting, and they really can't blame anyone else. And I was surprised. I went off on a fishing trip more than a year ago. And I was with a guide, a young guy, really good guide, but very young, naive guy, hardly been off out of the area at all. And his uncle had died of COVID. His father had COPD and a heart condition, and his girlfriend was pregnant. And I said, are you guys vaccinated? He said, no. And I started to say, let me talk to you. But I'm standing there on this boat instead of paying attention to the trout. I'm standing there giving him a lecture about vaccines and explaining why, particularly for his girlfriend, I was trying to explain how women's immune systems are suppressed while they're pregnant and why they are and why she was particularly. And his response was, wow, why didn't somebody tell me this? And I thought, no, you know, you can't wait for some guy to be standing up in your boat, to get this.
What you
got to
do is you got to wait for the guy who won the Pulitzer Prize on this issue to show up in your boat, and then you could get the information.
Right. But so many people say that. Why wasn't I told? Why wasn't I told? Well, you know, don't watch sports. Watch news, you know, or you know, pay attention to, you know, the ads on the subway that tell you the vaccines work, or, you know, listen to the public service ads. Don't do anything about it. You know, it was all over the place. And yet people resist learning because they sort of, you know, they really only trust, you know, what they hear from their friends and neighbors. And if their friends or neighbors are saying, you know, anti-vaccine things, then they're going to, you know, get sucked in with those.
Donald G. McNeil Jr., 1954.medium.com is the way to find some of Donald McNeil's writing. You just Google Donald McNeil and Medium. He is coming out with a book on and called The Wisdom of Plagues. Thank you very much for your wise, informed, and blunt and honest assessments. Great talking to you.
Thank you very much for having me. Hope I didn't ramble on too much. It's hard for me to stop once I get on top of it. Okay.
I felt like we were all a guide in a boat and you were giving us great advice.
Tight lines.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
And now the spiel. President Biden is in Ireland to mark the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, long seen as one of those intractable problems of sectarian tensions. The Good Friday Agreement proved the tensions in Ireland to be actually tractable. But the New York Times ran a front page analysis of treaties in general, and specifically the decline of treaties in recent years, for Biden, an era when treaties are more likely to be broken than brokered. It would be too much to call it the death of diplomacy, but there certainly is a dearth of diplomacy for now. This immediately caught my attention. You know me, I'm a negotiation table half full kind of guy. My initial analysis was that you start running out of peace agreements when you start running out of wars. And while it's true that the war in Ukraine is the bloodiest bilateral conflict since the Syrian Civil War, it's also true that as of late, we've been on kind of a worldwide peace kick. In recent years, but not the most recent, as I will soon lay out. As to the question, are there fewer treaties than before? Well, a good list of some of the more prominent treaties are available on Wikipedia, and the answer seems to be yes. During the Cold War, there have been some years when peace was breaking out all over, once again a function of war having been the prelude. In 1994 alone, there were 8 peace treaties. But a peace treaty doesn't always mean peace. Take the Budapest Memorandum on Security Assurances, which provides security guarantee to Kazakhstan and Belarus from the U.S. and the U.K., but it also provided a security guarantee to Ukraine from Russia. So, not all of that worked out. The same year, there was the Bishkek Protocol, a, quote, provisional ceasefire agreement between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Since those two territories are still involved in a low-grade but certainly deadly armed conflict to this day, you could note that the only part of the protocols that was true was the word provisional before ceasefire. In the history of treaties, there are over 20 that are listed as the Treaty of Paris or the Paris Accords or Protocols. It starts in the 1229 Treaty of Paris through the 1323 Treaty of Paris, in which Count Louis I of Flanders relinquished Flemish claims over the County of Zeeland. And we get to the 1355 Treaty of Paris, which recognized the annexation of the Barony of Gex by the County of Savoy, which, from what I understand, vexed the Gex, but was to the Savoie, fair. Gex, spelled G-E-X, but pronounced Gex, is a sub-prefecture of the close-to-Switzerland French arrondissement of Aisne, spelled A-I-N. It's not actually Aisne. Here's how it's pronounced. Yeah. That's right. But anyway, that was just the third Treaty of Paris. Several treaties of Paris later, we get to the Treaty of Paris that ends the Seven Years' War, and that is called, ready, the First Treaty of Paris. Soon thereafter, there's the 1783 Treaty of Paris that ends the American Revolution, which is dubbed the Second Treaty of Paris. Wikipedia lists 10 more until the 20th listed Treaty of Paris shows up as the Seventh Treaty of Paris. That is the one recognizing Romanian sovereignty over Bessarabia. It's part of Moldova now. Okay, three more since then. You know them all. The one that ended World War II in Europe, the one that ended the Vietnam War, and the Paris Agreement governing greenhouse gas emissions, or it was an agreement until Donald Trump disagreed. There were some treaties I didn't know existed. The Convention for the Suppression of Unlawful Acts Against the Safety of Civilian Aviation, a.k.a. the Don't Hijack a Plane Treaty. There are treaties that are clearly just not working. The Convention on Cybercrime, said to, quote, prohibit the use of computers or networks as tools for criminal activity. Not going so well. And there are treaties which are important, but odd. The Agreement on the Transfer of Corpses. It's something of a living document. It's important to have such treaties, even if they are set to expire. This list doesn't even include the non-multilateral agreements, such as decrees within a nation, like in 1902, China's Empress Dowager Cixi issued an anti-foot-binding edict, but it was soon rescinded. What do you expect? It was a non-binding resolution. But back to Biden and the Irish. 1998 saw the Good Friday Agreement, but then 1999, the Kumanovo Agreement, which concluded the Kosovo War. Then in 2000, the Algiers Agreement, which was a peace agreement between Eritrea and Ethiopia, formally ended the Eritrean-Ethiopian War. 2001, the Ohrid Agreement ended the armed conflict between the Albanian National Liberation Army and Macedonia, which is now called North Macedonia, and why it got to be called North Macedonia, also because of a treaty. Now, all of that, what a run. That was some diplomacy with big D energy. And so I thought tensions had cooled. The U.S. wound down its wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. The former, that was ended by the Doha Agreement, which was listed in the Times article, whose print title was Global Power Struggles Signal an End to the Era of Diplomacy. The Doha Agreement, by the way, was not listed as some sort of great triumph of treaties, more of a regrettable retreat. But sadly, we may be entering a new era. Because even though on this program I've often pointed out that we're living in quite the golden age as far as world conflicts, and I further noted that two of the three worst conflicts in the last couple years are winding down, not even Afghanistan in the last couple years, I'm talking about Tigray and Ethiopia and Yemen, the Ukraine war is such a bloodbath it is reshaping the picture. It's not as bad as Syria, it's not as bad as the 98 to 2008 Second Congo War, which is the least recognized, most horrific war of my lifetime, something like 5.5 million dead. But in 2022, not only did Ukraine break out, the simmering internal conflict in Myanmar got more bloody. Violence all over Africa, the Horn of Africa, the Sahel, the Maghreb, that broke out. France withdrawing from key countries, the Wagner Group moving in. So indeed, it was a period of relative peace, but it has been followed what we're in now, a period of bloodshed. But there are signs of hope. Tigray, like I said, has had a peace agreement in place since November. It really does look like it's working out. The Saudis seem to have soured on furthering their fight in Yemen. And some conflicts aren't ended by treaty, but by defeat. Joseph Kony, the Lord's Resistance Army, defeated Boko Haram in Nigeria, still operating far less lethally than before. Even these victories, of course, come with costs. But sometimes a peace treaty isn't possible until one side gets the upper hand or both sides realize there's no such thing as the upper hand. So let us celebrate the Good Friday Agreement. Let's not despair for future treaties, even though we're in a trough. And let's remember, when the going gets rough and the fighting seems fiercest, history has shown we'll always have Paris. And that's it for today's show.
Sing it, Sam.
You must remember this.
Corey Wara is the producer of not just The Gist, but also Accords, Agreements, and Protocols worldwide. Joel Patterson is not just the senior producer of The Gist, but also a strict adherent to the third basket of the Helsinki Accords. It's my favorite basket. Michelle Pesca is vice president of philanthropy and conflict mediation for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Peru, and thanks for listening.